Because usually I go to post the exact same article and you do it like a minute before me. And I'm like, fuck you, man. Fuck you.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Richard Wally, you are from Portland.
I'm from Portland. Oh, you paused. I fucked it all up.
Richard Wally, you are from Portland, Oregon.
And Cassidy, you're from an apartment in that California area known as Orange County.
Yes. There is an Orange County in Florida.
In that place?
Yes. Yeah.
We don't talk about that place.
No, we try not to. Richard.
Cassidy.
You sound different.
I sound amazing. Well, I'd like to announce that I got a new microphone.
So yes.
I need to send a shout out to my technical advisor, Daniel Robertson, for hooking me up and finding me a better recording device. Because I don't know anything about tech stuff, so.
Sounds smooth and silky.
Like jazz, baby.
So, good. Well, actually, maybe we'll start to get halfway professional on this get-up, this dog and pony act.
No, it'll still be a dog and pony act. So, do you ever do this? Sorry, this is random. Do you ever make up stories about people, like, that you don't... Because, see, now that I've moved away from, like, a lot of my friends and stuff like that, mm-hmm. the ones I don't see as much, like, I make up stories about them. Like, in my mind, the lady you live with is insane. And she, like, is, like, this foreign person. I know she isn't really. But I have this whole, like, dialogue, like, going about her and, like, things that happen in your life. Is that strange?
No, I think I do that a lot, too. I thought you meant stories that you actually tell to other people.
But... Well, I've done that, too, before. But that's just for fun, to fuck with people.
No, but I do that where somebody will, like, before I started that driving job, the last job I had in Pocatello, or as a med delivery guy, I was always hearing about certain people from that job from Keith, who was on the show last week, and his girlfriend, because they both had the job before me, and they would always talk about certain people who worked there, and they built these elaborate characters out of these people, and I was quite disappointed when I actually met them in person.
They were boring.
Yeah, yeah. they were just people. Like, you know Keith, when he,
he's an elaborator and a storyteller.
Yes, and when he doesn't like somebody, he oftentimes exaggerates their worst qualities.
Well, that got you in a lot of, trouble at one of your apartments.
Yes.
You learned that yelling through the floor was a bad idea.
The bee in apartment 23 or whatever. yeah, no, that's a long story.
The other thing, too, though, is if a movie is really crappy, but there's somebody in the film that looks like somebody I know, I plug the person I know into the film. I had this old coworker that looked a lot like Tom Cruise, but from specifically Mission Impossible 2 with the long hair and everything. Mm-hmm. And so I hated that movie while it was happening in my face. And so I would plug in this person I knew into the film. And it made it so much more, like, personal, because this guy, you know, I was like, no, Zach, don't go there. And so I just recommend that to people.
I don't know if I do that. No, I think that's unique to you.
Oh, so I'm insane. Okay, cool. Got you.
Insane, creative, same difference.
Well, no, I think you should try it. The next time you're not having fun, if there's somebody you kind of see, or like Orange is the New Black. Mm-hmm. The one that looked like another friend of ours, Sean.
That was... yes, that is true. That was hard not to think about.
Was that creepy to you?
I'm glad I wasn't the only one, because, I mean, he looks a lot like him. He's a lot taller and more rednecky, but
when I noticed... gestures and the voice, too, yeah, though.
When I noticed it, I could not see it.
Oh, yeah, it was fucking... I actually kind of loved it. By the end, I was like, no, Sean, don't go there. Like, it wasn't even the character anymore. It was...
Quit the assaulting these women.
Yeah. No, I thought that was pretty accurate, actually.
Wow. All right. Well, what have you been up to? What have you been doing?
Oh, what have I been doing?
You just got back from something or other.
Some swanky, yeah. No, we just went to a friend's house, and this friend couple of ours, we played video games, the Scott Pilgrim video game, while they baked, because they're like bakers and they do that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And so we get to have our fun and they have our fun. It's a weird play date, but yeah, it was fun.
I regret asking you about it. On Friday, was it Friday? Yeah. Me and my other graduate friends, we went out to a Korean barbecue. I don't know if you've ever been to like an authentic Korean barbecue.
Yeah, I have.
You have? Mm-hmm. Where they have the little barbecue pits that are like in the middle of your table, and they stand over your shoulder and cook the meat for you and put it on your plate as you're like conversing with your people.
No, maybe I haven't. I mean, I've gone to like the Ichibana, whatever, like grills where they cut up and fling meat at you and stuff.
I think that's more Japanese.
It is Japanese, but yeah. I haven't been to a Korean.
Well, the Korean barbecue, and I never done this before, so I thought this was really noteworthy. You order in like groups, like you order like a 4-person or a 5-person, and they just bring out this huge plate of raw meat, and then a ton of weird little sides that you don't know what anything is, on tiny saucers all over the table, and then. Yeah, they just start, like, cooking the meat on this, like, grill that's in the middle of the table while you're, like, you just have to ignore them. And then you kind of mix it together with the things that you're not sure what they are. The whole thing really stressed me out.
It's more, the story is better just because it's you, not because grilling or anything.
Yeah, not
just
because
you're an anxious person.
Interesting, yeah. I didn't know what anything was, and people were like, no, eat this, it's a, like, weird gelatin thing. It's like, okay, and then I'm like, am I supposed to put it in the rice thing, like a wrap, like a taco? And I'm sure I was doing it wrong. I was doing everything wrong.
See, my brother had a Korean roommate, and it was kind of like that. He was just cooking all the time, and he'd be like, eat, 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 and I would. But I liked it. I enjoyed it, because, I mean, I never had to cook.
Yeah. Movie news, let's get to it.
Yeah, let's do. We were just fucking
rambling. Let's abandon this. I'll let you start. What do you have?
Oh, good. I get a start. So let's just get this out of the way, because this is like an every week thing, because they're like the only movie anything that's happening anymore. it's kind of true. So Elizabeth Olsen, we've already talked about her being rumored, but she officially confirms that she's playing Scarlet Witch in Avengers Age of Ultron.
Yeah.
So that's going to be exciting.
They were looking at a few different people, including Saoirse Ronan and a few others, but it's a fish. It's going to be Elizabeth Olsen.
She's really interesting, so I think that's the best choice. And then also, we'll just tag on more Marvel news.
This week in the unofficial Marvel segment...
Yeah, no kidding, right? Marvel's Daredevil series is probably going to be scripted by Drew Goddard, which is super exciting. Mm-hmm. The dude from Cabin in the Woods. So
yeah, he was also a co-writer of a lot of Buffy and other Joss Whedon television series. Yeah,
and Lost, and he
and
did
Lost.
Stuff.
Yeah,
he did stuff with his life.
Mm-hmm.
Not like us. We eat at Korean restaurants.
Cool. This is the Netflix show that we talked about last week.
Yes.
So a lot of people have now speculated because of this that means that Joss Whedon, in some way, shape, or form, has his fingers in what's going on over at Netflix as well.
Oh, sure.
Or do you think it could just be a coincidence?
Oh, a coincidence. No, I mean, it's like, I mean, I think that's how Hollywood works in general. Like, mm-hmm. I don't, it didn't really surprise me, but it made a lot of sense. And I was like, good. I want to see more from that man anyways. I think he's a talented guy. So,
yeah. So, I mean, it's a very creative screenplay. And his television credits speak for themselves. So, obviously, he knows how to work with serialized storytelling. It could be good.
I think that that's good news, yes.
Okay, tell me if you think this is good news. We may get a Wonder Twins movie starring Mila Kunis and Ashton Kutcher.
Do you think that's true or a joke?
I don't know. So the story goes, there's this comic shop who they regularly get posters and swag from different media companies, and they were sent a poster. And it's linked on our Facebook page if you want to see it. But basically, it just shows like a purple background, like a universe kind of nebula, the Wonder Twins symbol, their fists, you know, uniting in the center. And it says, Activate 2014, Kunis and Kutcher. But the theories I've read in the comment section, and maybe they could be correct, is that there has been in the works a Entourage movie, and the Entourage television show always had like fake comic book movies that were going on in the background of the stories. Like for a few seasons, it was the Aquaman movie, and they think that maybe this could be a fake movie that's going to be in the Entourage movie, a movie within the movie.
That makes more sense to me because of all the characters that. If DC got the Wonder Twins off the ground and none of their other characters, it's like, okay, guys.
You're not even trying anymore.
Yeah, this is bad. This is bad.
I'll tell you, I would be into this. Like, if it was a real Wonder Twins movie, I would be into it if they went full-on comedy.
Okay, like, okay. This
made
is
it
what,
a farce.
Right. I figured you'd go that way. My real what I'd want out of it is I'd want them to try to make it really dark and gritty. And fuck up really bad and make it a so bad it's good movie, but not on purpose, if you know what I'm talking about.
Well, it could only be one or the other.
I know, but I just want it so inflated and fucking, and just like one of those things you look back at and it's almost like the apple. There's even like singing parts in it. That's what I want. So
see, I think it could be, I think like if you treated it like a comedy and let Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis just revert back to their That 70s Show characters and do it like that and like just made it like a really stupid, like almost kind of Mystery Man-esque comedy, sure. I think it could actually be a lot of fun.
Would there be a whole incest thing then there too? Like,
oh, sure. They could tease that. They could do a ton of things if they opened it up to farce.
Oh, fair enough.
And the talking monkey, I could be down for. But if this is like a real blockbuster and they just like, you know, just go in and like stop some giant evil, I would be massively disappointed and bored.
It depends. If they failed really bad, I'd be pretty excited.
Yeah, if they fail grand, you know, if you fail big, that's what I always say.
Yes.
Okay, what's your next story?
So this has been in the rumors for a while, and I remember something way back when. I think it's even before we did the podcast, they've been talking about a Preacher series, and Seth Rogen is possibly on board. He's producing. I knew that he had something to do with trying to get it up, but specifically they're doing a Preacher pilot at AMC, and that's what the news is.
The
what
Seth
do you
Rogen
think
part,
about this? I want to hear.
The Seth Rogen part is like speculative, but it is being somewhat greenlit or looked at AMC. I don't know. We've talked about it a little bit on the podcast. I think we talked about, you know, comics that we'd like to see adapted. And it's a great series. It's really creative and has a interesting kind of almost spaghetti western meets Neil Gaiman-esque retelling of biblical history. And it's hard to explain. You just have to read it. But it's, I don't see AMC doing it.
I don't either.
I don't see them doing it well anyway. I think they would have to neuter the content because a big part of what makes that comic a kick is that it's transgressive and subversive, and, you know, basically it was just out to piss off middle American Christianity.
And to be blatant, it's balls to the wall. I mean, even things that aren't trying to piss off, they're really, they go there.
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff in there that is really kind of sick and twisted, and, you know, you're dealing everything from bestiality to incest to making fun of suicide. I mean, I just don't see this being able to be what it needs to be on AMC, as much as I like that channel.
My first question was, on AMC, how do they do Meat Man?
Actually, I think that'd almost be one of the easier ones to deal with, because you could do everything off camera. And still,
yeah, but that would take away the potency, and that would take... I don't think so. To me, that scene, when it comes up, and it's like a big, huge, full-page shot in the comic.
Yeah.
Like, I do not see that being like, oh, it's off camera. I don't think it would give you much appeal. But if you do it HBO style, and you show
It needs to be HBO or Encore or something where they don't have to worry about censors at all, where they actually have a sex and gratuity quota to meet.
Yeah.
Because I think it would exceed their quota within the first 10 minutes of every episode.
Agreed.
So I don't know. Hopefully, is there even a point in being hopeful?
I don't know. I'm so hesitant about that, because the thing that worries me the most isn't any of the other stuff besides the AMC thing, just because, again, I don't know if they can pull off the content. Yes, it's not the, you know, one of the major channels, and they can go pretty far with it. Yeah. And I mean, that you can't, you have something in Walking Dead that they really push it to the edge.
Yeah.
But this needs to go further.
Yeah. This needs to go beyond the edge. The edge needs to be a distant dot.
This needs to be in bad taste many of the time.
Yeah, that's the glory of the comic, is that it's a celebration of bad taste.
Yes.
And also there is something about the tone of that comic that's a little hard to get right, and I think they have to realize that it's sort of purposely transgressive, and it's kind of satirical and funny a lot of the times, even though it's disgusting. It's kind of you're almost supposed to laugh at it, and I'm afraid they would take it seriously. I mean, they would make it just like grim and dusty and you know what I mean, and try and make it too cool.
Well, that's my problem with. I actually wouldn't have even as much a problem if they said FX, because FX, you know, they'll do funny. They do funny stuff as well. They don't just, you know, make it super serious. I can't think of any AMC comedies really. Period. Yeah.
Although I was kind of thinking about that, like, you know, it got me thinking about the stuff I've seen on AMC. Vince Gilligan, if he were able to, the creator of Breaking Bad, if he were able to have a bigger budget and be on HBO, I think he would understand the content.
Oh, yeah, I could see that.
But yeah, I don't know. That'll be strange. We'll see what happens.
It's always been one of those ones, though. I mean, honestly, it's always been a product where I'm like, it would have to be right place, right time, right people.
Yeah, and I think it's never happened. They've talked about it forever. It's one of those things, I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, it's a hard nut to crack, too, honestly. So
yeah. It's your turn for the pet topic.
It is.
And I'll let you go ahead with that.
I was actually struggling to come up with this pet topic, but now that I've, like, sat here and I've thought about it, I have a few different ones that I'm actually kind of excited about. So my question is, because of the new Darren Aronofsky Noah trailer,
mm-hmm.
are there specific directors or specific Bible stories that you want told on the big screen, or?
Yeah, I thought this was an interesting topic. Largely because there is a lot of historical biblical epics that are in the pipeline now.
Right.
Not just the Aronofsky one, but I think we talked a little while back about some others that I've already forgot. But
yeah, there's a Ridley Scott Moses, the Exodus specifically, I think. And then there was a Stephen, not Stephen King, what the fuck, Steven Spielberg one.
something or other.
It was also a Moses. There was a lot of Moses happening at one point.
It's going to be the year of the Moses.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, we talked about how, like, biblical epics at a point in time was kind of a staple in genre filmmaking. Right. You know, especially in, like, the 50s and 60s. And maybe a little bit before that. But you had movies like Ben-Hur and The Robe and Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments. And around the same time as all those, like, Sword and Sandals movies. It was a big deal to do biblical epics, and they always had these big, you know, widescreen Technicolor displays. They were, like, the special effects movies of their time. We don't talk about this on the podcast very often, I'm not sure if at all, but I come from a somewhat religious background.
Sure.
My father is a practicing minister. I don't believe in the God so much, but...
Pretty typical story.
Yeah.
My father was a pastor. I'm an atheist.
Right? Yeah. I'm a walking cliche. That's okay. But I do know, actually a lot about the Bible and a lot of Bible stories. And as a kid, I was able to really appreciate some of the stories as stories, whether or not I believed in them. So I'm thinking back. I actually just had this conversation the other night when I was at the stressful Korean barbecue. when we were somehow we got on the topic of The Passion, the Mel Gibson movie.
Sure.
And we were talking about what that movie was and, you know, the controversy surrounding it. And I had stated, if you really wanted to do a story about the crucifixion, if you really wanted to make a story about that, I think the most interesting way to do that story would be to tell that story from the perspective of Barabbas, the prisoner who was released by the Jews instead of Jesus because they wanted to see Jesus go down so bad.
No.
I think that would be a really interesting movie as far as just as like a narrative writing problem to solve, to figure out like what would be his perspective of that.
Do you have a director for it?
It's just kind of an idea.
I have a director. I think Steve McQueen should do your version.
Ooh, I'd be into that.
Yeah, I know. I'm a genius at this. I should do this for Olympic, actually.
I want to see that movie I just made up right now.
Yeah. I should cast for it and pick the director and everything. I'm producing now. I think
you could do a really interesting story, because the cool thing about the Bible, whether or not you believe in them as historical documents or not, the cool thing about the story, or the thing about the Bible, is that they tell these grand narratives. They tell these big, overarching, thematic stories. And you can really tap into some of those kind of universals in those stories and be able to maybe even take a subversive look at those themes. But I think a story about Cain and Abel would be really interesting. I mean, the idea that these brothers... one is really jealous because he's favored by God. I always, maybe this is how an early inkling in my person, that I always kind of felt bad for the characters in the Bible that are always painted as the villain.
Sure.
Because I was always like, no, he has a story. Like I probably hate Abel too. Like, fucking asshole. Like, so yeah, I don't know. I think you could do an interesting story there. I think you could do an interesting story with John the Baptist. I don't know. There's a lot of like great, almost kind of Greek tragedy type stuff in there.
I don't have a good one for the Cain and Abel. I'm really disappointed. There'd have to be a really good like family drama kind of stuff, kind of person. Really, really serious though and tearing. I have three right off the top of my head.
Okay.
Are you ready for them? I have directors and everything for them.
All right. Pitch me.
The first one I don't have actors for, and I don't have it completed yet in my head, but I have an idea. I want Terry Gilliam to do an Adam and Eve story.
Ooh.
Yeah. I want him to do it like really fucking surrealist and crazy as hell.
Yeah.
And I don't mean Terry Gilliam like, together. I mean Terry Gilliam like bash it crazy.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
Like Dr. Parnassus style.
Yes. Like, yeah. Give him full like
Final like, cut.
Go crazy, buddy. Send him in the corner and let him go.
Yeah.
I want that movie.
I could be down.
My second one is I want a Edgar Wright, Jonas in the Well story with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost and that kind of like an arc.
Who's the other characters besides Jonah and the whale?
I don't know. Jonah and the Well is a really strange story to me because everybody's always like talking about how good Jonah is, but that's not what that story is about, like at all. Jonah's an asshole. Like, let me just say that. Yeah, I want to see a big satirical Edgar Wright, but maybe like mix it, maybe bring in some of the Monty Python guys to try to like kind of fill it out, help him out with it.
I get you.
Yeah, yeah. My third one is a Michael Bay film.
Oh my!
Of Walls of Jericho.
Yeah, I mean, if he was gonna do one, it'd be like that or Sodom and Gomorrah, like something with a lot of explosions.
No, yeah, but Sodom and Gomorrah, there's too much going on there, and I don't want to see him being, you know, using any broad stereotypes or anything. So I just stared clear of that fucking one. So I went straight to that one because I mean, I don't know, I just see these super masculine people like marching around a wall and like grunting at each other, and then the walls explode, and I don't know,
yeah,
whatever else would happen in that kind of film.
Giant. Celestial Transformer comes out of the sky and yeah,
that's Transformers 4.
Which is happening. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I actually, the funny thing is, like, Cecil B. DeMille, like, we consider him as, like, this great old director, like, you know, half of the campus that I'm on, the film and television section of the campus I'm on is named after Cecil B. DeMille because we got some sort of funding from his estate. So there's, like, the Cecil B. DeMille Hall and the Cecil B. DeMille this or that all over the place. But Cecil B. DeMille was, like, a big hack director. He kind of was the Michael Bay of his time.
Sure.
Like, he made these big, expensive, gaudy, silly movies that nobody really takes seriously anymore, like The Ten Commandments, which is one of his better movies, and The Greatest Show on Earth, which right. is largely considered one of the worst Oscar winners.
I see what you're saying, yeah. I mean, but he did have kind of a big contribution to Hollywood.
No, yeah, and he pushed special effects, and he his movies made a lot of money, and they were kind of crowd-pleasing. But, like, that's the idea of getting somebody like Michael Bay to do a historical biblical epic is not... It's almost in tradition.
Yeah, yeah.
Were back then. A lot of those movies were kind of junky, and that's what's kind
of
makes
it fun. Even though I said it sort of jokey, I was kind of serious. Like, I would go see that.
Oh, yeah, me too.
I would rather see him do stuff like that. Please keep him away from, like, I want you to put him in weird things that people would be like, okay, but maybe go see. I don't know why, but that just makes sense to me.
Yeah, but under that logic, doesn't that make, like, the Pearl Harbor movie exciting, even though it wasn't?
That was a different time, though. This is the new Michael Bay. This is post-Transformers. Like, at that time period, he was trying to do stuff with his life. And this time, he's like, let's blow shit up. I don't even give a fuck no more.
Fair enough. You only got, like, half cynicism back then.
Yeah.
Now he just goes for broke.
Yeah, might as well.
Yeah. All right, well...
That Come on, I had some pretty good
No, ones. I'm in, I think all of this needs to happen. I'm into it.
I should be a producer for the Bibles. The Bible, I don't know what it would be. It'd be like Marvel Studios, but
yeah.
But Bible stories, I guess. We'll leak them all in one universe.
Oh my god. Like that, I'm surprised that hasn't happened. I'm really honestly surprised that hasn't happened. Okay, well, we got to move on. We'll talk about our movie reviews, and we didn't talk about this at the top of the show. What the hell are we reviewing, Richard?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what you saw.
Well, I was only able to see basically About Time is what we're going to end up reviewing.
Okay. Because we talked about a little bit online about what was coming out, what wasn't coming out, and what you wanted to see. And we thought we were going to be reviewing Nebraska, but that's... only opened in like 4 screens right now, so we're waiting for that one to open a little wider before we can talk about it. But yeah, so I suggested let's go back and look at About Time. Do you want me to
please set it up? Yeah,
set it up. Oh, you want me to set it up? Okay. So About Time is written and directed by Richard Curtis, the British romantic comedy director who also did movies like Love Actually and Notting Hill and Pirate Radio. And he's kind of coming back to his usual kind of shtick here with a sort of a time travel rom-com of sorts.
That's kind of becoming like a staple, though.
It's almost
becoming the rom-com time travel.
Yeah, it's almost becoming an actual genre now.
Yeah. Or subgenre, I don't know what you call it.
And Rachel McAdams, who's in this, was in one of the other staples of that genre, The Time Traveler's Wife. And she plays a character named Mary. The main character is played by Domhnall Gleeson, son of the Harry Potter guy. What's his name?
Bill Nighy?
No, Gleeson. Brendan Gleeson is his dad.
Oh, he's like a real... You're talking real.
I'm talking about real people and the real people.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Go on. I was confused.
Every British person ever was in the Harry Potter movie, so I...
Yeah, that was a bad one, too. Yeah.
His father in the movie, who is not his actual biological father, is played by Bill Nighy, who has also worked with Richard Curtis in various other movies. And he informs him, when he's about 19, 20 years old, that all the males in his family have this ability to time travel. And he treats it rather cavalierly, like it's, you know, matter-of-factly, we can time travel. And it's actually a fairly simple process. You just go into a dark space, a closet, or a cubby or something like that. You clench your fists, think of the time you want to go, and poof, you're there. You can travel back to the time that you traveled from, but you can't go any further into the future. As we go on with the story, you realize there are some effects of the time travel that are kind of problematic, but for the most part, we're meant to sort of ignore that for the first half of the movie, when he falls in love with this character played by Rachel McAdams, and he tries to use the time travel to his advantage to make sure that they fall in love and have a happy life together. The second half of the movie really starts to steer further and further away from comedy, and gets a lot more serious as far as this whole idea of live every moment and appreciate your life the way it is, and you can't fix everything and be in control of everything all the time, and you have to make sacrifices and blah blah blah. I have to say, I was a lot more happy with this movie as kind of a light romantic comedy that had, you know, that kind of Richard Curtis-y wit and character, neurotic characters and da-da-da-da-da, and the funny repertoire between the romantic leads and all of that stuff that I knew it was going to be walking in. The more and more serious it got, and more heavy it got, and once we start introducing, you know, car crashes and cancer into the mix, I really started to lose patience with it, and I felt like it just was getting, I don't know, overly sentimental and heavy for really no reason.
Sure. No, I pretty much agree with you. It was light and fluffy and acceptable. It was fairly witty. It was exactly what I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, I was pretty bored with it. And to be honest, I think part of it, this is a fantasy movie like any kind of escapist fantasy movie.
Yeah.
If we could go back and relive our, you know. And yeah. So, I mean, it's a big
what-if scenario.
I didn't necessarily get annoyed with that serious stuff happened. I got more annoyed that it was just all like some of the, I mean, even though they kind of tried to go there, in general, it was just light and fluffy. Nothing really happened.
See, I thought plenty happened. I felt like the movie, I don't know, I felt the movie could have been lighter and fluffier.
No, even if something light did happen, it was uneventful because he went back in time and he changed it perfectly. Even though, you know, the perfect sperm didn't hit or whatever.
that's a plot detail that's hard to explain. But no, I don't know. Like, when it was just at the beginning and it was just a high-concept romantic comedy and it was just about, like, awkward situations and funny side characters. Like, there's a character in here.
The really nerdy one?
No, there was a few that I really enjoyed. He was funny, too, I think.
Which one? I guess there was two, because there was a super redheaded one that's from the third batch of kids in skins.
That's all you. I don't know.
Will Merrick is his name.
Yeah.
He played almost the exact same character, but he was pretty delightful.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm talking about his uncle in the movie that's played by Tom Hollander.
Oh yeah, I love that guy.
He was from Hannah, and he was also in The Loop.
Yeah, he was just pleasant but really stupid.
Yeah. In this, he plays like this consummate grouch, he's extremely funny. Whenever he's on screen, he steals the show.
Oh, you're talking not at the uncle. You're talking the playwright.
Yeah, the playwright that he lives with for a little while.
No. It was just a friend of his. The uncle was the impeccable dressed one that just, he was there and he was pleasant, but he didn't really do anything.
I think he had like an Alzheimer's or something like that was sort of the joke with him. Yeah. Tom Hollander is really funny in this, and he's a really standout part of the movie. And he, I don't know, like his character and like Rachel McAdams' friend and a few other, like, it was, had kind of a fun, light, breezy, sort of almost sort of screwball comedy feel to it for like the first hour, and then it decided to plunge into Lifetime TV of the Week waters and get all weepy, and that's when I lost patience with the movie.
I knew it was going to do that. I thought it was going to do it more with the wife, though. That's what I got from the previews. So I was actually glad it didn't go there.
Mm-hmm.
Like she was going to die or get cancer or whatever. And I don't know. Again, this is one of those movies. I don't really have a lot to say. It was what it was supposed to be, exactly for the crowd it was supposed to be. And so, I mean, if you're into light, fluffy movies, then yes, go to this. Won't be disappointed. I personally was bored.
Yeah, well, but that's the thing. I think that there's a version of this movie that wouldn't have been as boring. Do you agree with me that the first half, the more comedic stuff, works better than the dramatic stuff?
I see, I already said it was kind of what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, but regardless.
Not really, because I think they kept it even pretty light after people were dying in car wrecks and of cancer.
That's what I mean.
To me, it wasn't like, there was no consequences to these dramatic things you're talking about. So to me, it wasn't that dramatic.
Well, no, that's what I mean, is that the drama doesn't work because it's already taking such a huge logical leap to get there. And I don't know, I felt like when it's playing with those, with the kind of sci-fi conceit as sort of jumping off point for comedy, then it's fine because it's sort of, you know, a farce. But if it is trying to use that conceit and then basically become a Nicholas Sparks movie, that's when I was like, why?
I see your argument. Like, I mean, I didn't really think that personally, but I get what you're saying. I think it could have been a little bit better if they would have, but to me it would have been marginally better and I still probably would have been a little bored.
Mm-hmm.
Even if, like, I mean, it was fun that he went back and he helped his playwright friend. It would be fun if he did that for, I guess, Jay and Rory and all the other weirdos that existed in his life.
Yeah.
His little lawyer friend and all that kind of thing. No, it's, I don't know. I don't really have a lot to say about this movie. It's exactly what I thought it was.
Okay. So it never disappointed you, really. Like,
it never did anything. Like, it was just like, okay, haha. And I laughed at it. So, yeah. I mean, you're right. He bring his normal wit to it, and it was acceptable.
Yeah, I think he's great, better at wit than he is at, you know, making people emotionally involved.
Sure. I think if you have a lady or man friend that likes this kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and you want like bonus points, this is a great movie. If you're not that kind of person.
Did you go with your wife?
I did go with my wife.
Did she enjoy it more than you?
Maybe a little, but
you don't have to lie.
No, I mean, but we also talked about how both of us, just as we're getting older, all that romance bullshit, we're like, like, we're just both curmudgeons at this point, and we just like our, I don't know. See, this is what we talked about specifically. We talked about how, like, romantic comedies and stuff, she says, I don't like watching them as much anymore because, first of all, they're always not accurate. And two, it's just a big fantasy escape for people who don't have real relationships.
Generally speaking, yeah.
And
but, I mean, one thing I'll give this movie as far as, like, you know, escaping a cliche of the romantic comedy. Usually the climax of a romantic comedy is they will, it, you know, they play the will they won't they game for the majority of the movie, and then, you know, the payoff is to see them get together.
This was just a big will you game.
Well, this movie, you know they're going to be together forever by the middle of the movie, and then the movie kind of switches tracks, and I don't like where it went, but at least it did avoid that romantic comedy comedy cliche.
Sure, I'll give it points for that. Like,
kind of an epic scope for the type of movie it is.
No, for people who go to these kind of films and like these kind of films, this would be the one that I would recommend, as opposed to any of the other Reese Witherspoon / Tristan Heigl / what any of those nameless blondes in my head.
Yeah,
I wouldn't ever recommend any of those, even though a lot of people do watch and like those. But I could never. But this one, I'd actually say no. It was cute and fluffy and acceptable.
Okay. Well, even yeah. I mean, I think Richard Curtis has a talent for taking what is essentially would be like the worst Hollywood film, and because he's, you know, it's kind of more traditionally British, and he gets to kind of use their witticisms and their kind of comedic rhythm. He can kind of dress it up. I mean, we saw how that happened with Love Actually, and then when it essentially was remade into Valentine's Day, you saw where all that, Love Actually work was just stripped away from the Gary Marshall stuff.
Sure. I get you. Yeah.
Yeah. I still thought this movie could have been a lot better. I think even for him, yes, I'm fine with light and fluffy. I didn't like when it tried to become weepy and serious.
Sure. But would you, but I mean, for our hypothetical listeners, would you recommend it?
As a rental.
As a rental, okay.
Yeah, I don't think this is worth $12 to see in theaters. It's not, there's nothing in here that isn't going to work just as well at home. And I think, even for Richard Curtis, I think it's on the low end of his.
Okay. No, I agree with the rental comment.
Yeah. But there is some stuff to like in here, specifically the peripheral characters. And I think that Gleason, young Gleason, as the lead, is good. And I can see him having a further career in film. And Rachel McAdams is kind of doing a Manic Pixie Dream Girl thing, but she's okay at doing that. Yeah, I don't know. It's fine. Whatever.
No. That was essentially my first comment.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I felt like I didn't add a lot to this, but I kind of felt like this would be my review.
Well, no. I understand. I just don't want, just because we're not into a genre, I don't want to, like, be too dismissive.
No, you've got a point. I just had a hard time even with this one because it was so like, okay.
Well, we'll move on then. We'll talk about our last segment of the show, which is our Netflix homework. You assigned to me last week Alfonso Cuarón's Y Tu Mamá También. And you know the Spanish tongue.
I know the tongue of the Spanish peoples of
yeah.
Spaniard places.
What does that title mean? What does that translate?
And your mother.
And your mother. Okay.
And your mother as well. It could be as well. You could translate it a few different ways.
Okay. And why don't you explain a little bit of what this is about?
Thanks, Cass. it's basically about these two teenagers that take this lady that they're both attracted to the beach.
Yeah.
And go on a little bit of a vacation. But it kind of wraps it around culturally, what's going on around them, and what's kind of going on with them mentally. No. This film actually, I think it's a great piece to watch post Gravity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the material itself is a little
much different.
It's much different, but I think that it's much deeper and much more. It's a little harder of a read. But I think Gravity gives you a good footwork to go into Karan's work. Because I caught a lot more after watching Gravity and picking up all the things that were happening in that. I picked up a lot more on the second viewing of this movie. And just, it kind of goes through what's happening within Mexico, around them.
Politically.
But just, yeah, politically, but just showing, you know, them just as kids. And also showing how life happens and what happens. And it kind of goes into some universalities, and it kind of, there are things that play, it's very much a poetry movie, because it goes back into themes, and things come back, and there's certain images that tie into other words that happen later in the movie. And it's a beautiful thing about life. And
It came out in 2001, and stars Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna, and they look like babies in this movie. I'm so used to seeing them now that I was like, how old is this? And then I looked, and it's like, oh, okay, it was a little while ago, but then, man, have they grown up just in the last 10 years?
Well, I think they've grown up a lot in the last 10 years, but I think that there was some choices made that made them look a little younger too. Because I saw a movie that was made around the same time, and that specifically Gael Garcia Bernal, he looked a lot older in it.
Okay. So they maybe played it up a little bit. Yeah. So last week when you assigned this to me, you were like, and when we talked about it a little bit after, you seemed sort of like hesitant about it. Like there was like this, oh boy, kind of, I just want to know why.
Not oh boy, necessarily.
But that, like, I should be prepared for something.
Not prepared. Well, the first time I watched it, I got my read had a lot more to do with sex.
Yes.
Because the movie is, I mean, one, it's very sexy, just straight up. Two, it's
very sexual.
Very sexual.
Yeah.
And it's almost hard to escape that, but I just noticed so much more about the film this time, and there were certain parts in it that I thought were about sex, but actually had very little to do with it. And so, I don't know, I kind of had a different read on it. And also, at one point, I considered that I wouldn't be getting Nebraska, and I would be seeing Blue as the Warmest Color. And so I thought that this whole episode would be this huge erotic thing for us, and I just wasn't know if I was ready to do that with you on a podcast. Take a big erotic adventure. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it is interesting actually to think of these two movies in conjunction. Not about time, but
sure.
Having just seen Blue is the Warmest Color, which we may or may not review on this podcast later, and then this, there is some commonality, specifically with the filmmaking. I agree. I really love this movie.
Oh no, it's beautiful. I think of all of his films, it's his best film. It's maybe not my favorite, but it is his best film.
As just being a film, you mean?
Yeah.
It's shot in somewhat of a documentary style, but it's also very picturesque as well. It's shot by Emmanuel Lubietzky, who also did Children of Men and Gravity and Tree of Life. It's an incredible cinematographer. You know, it's basically a road movie, essentially, if you just, you know, strip it down to genre. It's about the two teenage boys. They take this married woman out off on the road, and it seems like to me, and I know that I would glean more from watching it more than once, but it seemed like a movie that was a lot about virility and sort of young sexual frustration and sort of how that plays out. And
I maybe a little bit. I see what you're saying, and I could see that on my first viewing of the film. I guess I would have got that, but then with the second thing, there were specifically shots and scenes that this is maybe a little bit of a spoiler. I don't know. So warning. But there's a specific shot where for me it was just really about sexuality. The first time I watched it, it was when they're at the pool and they're jerking off, and they come into the pool.
Yeah.
And
I don't think it's a spoiler, but it is a moment.
It is. Well, it's a moment, but what the flip side is that what I didn't catch the first time is there's a scene where specifically the, that the Luisa Cortez character, who also, we got to talk about the acting, because the acting is fucking great.
Oh, yeah, all the way around. All three of these leads are incredible together.
Yeah. I'll finish my thought and then we'll go into that. But she there's basically a scene where she starts to swim in the ocean almost at the very end. And they talk about the sea foam.
Mm-hmm.
And it all clicked and tied together. And there was, like, different scenes that all did that with. And I saw how scenes from the first were tying into scenes at the end. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I didn't see this the first time. This is... And it is something similar to the way that he paced and told the story of Gravity. So it's a storytelling way that he does movies. But it's beautiful, and it's unlike... a lot of movies I've seen, it's actually kind of hard to compare almost. It's its own thing. But going into the there is a heavy sensuality and charisma and sure between all these different actors.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually the most impressed because I already knew Bernal was the one that I'd seen the most of. He's pretty famous.
Yeah.
Or pretty popular at his level. Diego Luna, this was the first movie I'd seen him in, I think, or at least noticed him in.
Yeah.
And I felt like he got less credit in this movie than maybe he deserved.
Well, he's been in other things as well. He was in Elysium. Plays a small part in Milk. So he kind of shows up every once in a while. I recognized his face right away, but I was like, is it him? Because he looks so young.
Well, he's ended up in the last few years.
Yeah.
Because I saw this quite a while ago. But also, Maribel Varela, she wasn't also in, like, Pan's Labyrinth.
Okay, yeah.
And she's been in a few other Spanish films and stuff like that. But I think, actually, she's one of the best parts of this film, personally, for me.
She is. Well, I mean, she seems to have... She's the character with the most amount of agency in the entire film, because the other two are basically in this constant kind of competition with each other, and they're sort of... they're so trying to impress... That you rarely get to see them without, like, the big machismo bravado.
Well, see, that's the first time I watched it.
And she's trying to break that the entire movie.
Well, also the first time I saw that movie, that's what I thought a lot of it was about as well. And, I mean, it is, I think, universal in the sense even with American macho-isms or whatever. But, but I thought it was more specific, and it rang more true because it was the machismo of the Latino culture.
However, and this would be a spoiler, so I won't go there, but there is a scene towards the end, kind of a pivotal scene, where something happens that really turns that whole machismo thing on its head, too, and you have to wonder what the story and the motivation of these characters really were. But I won't go into that. Kind of funny anecdote, though. While watching this, I had the DVD that I bought from Hollywood Video when it went out of business.
Sure.
I've been meaning to watch it forever, so it was good that you assigned this to me so I could finally watch it. But I watched it, and I noticed that, like, the editing of the sex scenes were kind of rushed and weird, and I just thought, like, it had just kind of went down in the annals of history how extreme this movie was, and I was like, oh, I mean, it's, you know, yeah, there's some sex in here, but it's not, like, so extreme. And then I looked and I realized that the Netflix version of it was 5 minutes longer.
Oh, okay.
I ended up having some, not clean flicks exactly, but some weird, cleaner, R-rated edit of the movie. So it is, when you see the film, I would suggest looking for the version of it that's 100, or that's an hour and 45. And not an hour and 40, because they specifically, at that last scene, when there's a thing that happens that I think's kind of a big deal in the movie, it was edited out of the DVD version.
Well, I think, you know, recanting kind of a little bit, I do think that that is a large part of what was happening in this movie as well, but I think it's a lot bigger than I thought it was the first time I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it is a part of an overarching larger thing that's happening in the movie itself. So the first time I watched it, I really tapped into the sexuality because it's fucking hard not to.
Well, yeah.
I mean, besides it just being, very erotic, it's done very sexy. And I don't know how to explain it because it's not. Well, there that's my best.
There is an aspect of the film, and I think this is done on purpose. There is an aspect of the film that plays kind of like a teenage fantasy. Because it, you know, this whole setup of this older married woman who's going out with these on the road with these two kids, and then she, you know, seduces them. That's essentially, you know, a kind of like I was mentioning before, kind of an 80s like a teen fantasy, kind of, you know, thing, almost kind of like Weird Science in a way. You know, I mean, they didn't build her, but kind of.
yeah. I the conceit is similar, yes. I wouldn't say
The execution totally different, and the purpose totally different. But I think there is an aspect of the movie that is sort of a fantasy, and yeah. I think that that's what how he explores these characters and these worlds this world that he's building and all of this, you know, Spanish culture stuff.
See, and I think that's how he brings you into the film. I don't think that's necessarily like how they would see. He brings you in through those tropes. But then he doesn't do anything.
No, yeah, he transgresses those or subverts them once he gets there.
Almost completely, because there's even parts in the first. I don't know. This is a beautiful film, and I would recommend it to most people. I don't know. I mean, I guess if you're not into the nuditudes or sex in general, I guess maybe stick clear, but
it is shocking. I mean, once it, you know, when it happens, it's very blunt the way it's shot. It's not shot, you know, despite the fact that I just called it a fantasy, it's not shot like that. It's not shot, it's shot in a way that almost kind of makes you feel uncomfortable, and I think it's supposed to, and I think that it's, but yes, I think it's a very, good movie. I think, almost a perfect film, really.
Agreed. I have, it's hard, I can't complain about it really.
Yeah. I've yet to see anything by this director that I've disliked, although I haven't seen Great Expectations, which he has disowned.
Have you seen Little Princesses?
I have not.
I haven't either, I was just curious.
I mean, I mean to, but I haven't yet.
No, I saw this film right before the Gravity stuff came out, and that's why I got so, like, jazzed. I mean, he did this is kind of a side note, but he did like my favorite Harry Potter. I started to kind of get a thing for this director and being like, oh, he has something.
Yeah.
And then they said the Gravity, and then I've seen Gravity, and it's all, I want him to do more movies. And I've heard the rumor is that his next movie might be a horror film. I would be so
happy,
fucking jazzed for that. Like, yeah.
I'd also like to see him kind of go back and make something on a small scale like this. And it just isn't to say that I don't like his blockbuster, because Children of Men and Gravity is incredible. But yeah. To know that he has this tool in his toolbox, it'd be interesting to see him kind of go back and make something independently again.
Agreed.
Well, cool. The movie that I wanted to assign you for next week is... I didn't ask you prior if you'd already seen it, but have you seen Brian De Palma's Dress to Kill?
No, I have not.
All right, cool. Well, it was a 1980 film, Brian De Palma. It's largely considered, you know, one of his standout works. Been meaning to see it forever, and it's on the Netflix queue now, so that is what we will review next week.
Okay, cool. I'm excited. He does good stuff in that period, so.
Yes. So, and if anybody has anything else to say about any of the movies that we talked about today, whether it be About Time or Y Tu Mama Tambien or any of the movies that came up in the periphery of those discussions, you can contact us at our email, which is jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also talk to us at our Facebook, facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can like us there and see whenever we post new episodes or news items in between episodes, some of which we don't talk about on the show. You can subscribe to us on iTunes if that is how you like to receive your MP3s and your podcasts. Just go to the podcast section of the iTunes store, look up Jabber and the Drone, and you should be able to find us. While you're there, give us a star rating and a one-sentence review. You can also find our review archives at jabberandthedrone.podbean.com, which is our... pretty much our homepage. We don't have an official .com, but I think Podbean does a pretty good job for us. So you can find our RSS feed there. Click on that. put it on your thing so that it makes the things happen. And I'm trying to get us on Stitcher Radio so that people can put us on their smartphones as an app.
Okay.
But it's just kind of a process. You have to apply for it, and I haven't heard back from them yet. But when that happens, I'll let everyone know.
Okay.
You can also read my movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com, where you can also comment on there or share or whatever you do. You can also read the movie column that I contribute to the MacGuffin podcast over in Seattle, which is mcguff.in/author/Cassidy, and you'll see all of the content there. I just uploaded a new top five article just a few days ago, so go look at that. And I don't know, Richard, you can find in non-existence now that the Richard sperm did not meet the egg, so now it's Richina.
No, it would be Dana. That was going to be the unisex name my mom wanted to call if it was a boy or a girl. I guess my dad vetoed that. I'm not really sure.
You don't want unisex names, believe me. All right, well, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, talk to you next week, Cassidy Robinson.
Bye.
Bye.